the hour of our death. Amen.
Glory be to the Father,
to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
Before we continue, whoever has the sign-up sheet last, please let me have it, because I end up losing it, and then I couldn't just in, and then I'll...
Okay, I don't have my board today. I forwent my board, so I have to do a... I'm going to do a review from here, because I have a little interactive entertainment for you during the talk. So, just as a review, can someone tell me what we've been talking about for the past 3 weeks, so it catches everyone else that haven't been here, like a two-second review. What are we talking about, basically?
Evangelization and missionary work.
Yes, evangelization and mission. And the first step, basically, in evangelization mission, if you want to imagine, it's like a circle, and there's extensions of that circle. And what's the most inner circle? That if we're going to be an evangelizing Christian, which is our identity, which we have to do by nature of the gift we received, what do we first have to be? And what do we first have to do?
Holy.
We have to be holy. In other words, we cannot give a gift we don't have, and that's holiness. It's receiving the gift of the Lord so that we can give that gift away to others. And then that we talked about how we need to do that through conversion. We need to change our hearts, basically, because we're not holy, and we need to become more so. And so we need to change and allow the Lord to do his work in us. And then the next thing he's calling us to be is a what? A?
Family,
yes. He's calling us to be a family. And we talked about the importance of that and how we need that is how the Lord asks us to be. It's not, the church is a body, and it's a body that functions together and works as one whole family. And so we're not just units, we're not just individuals that do whatever we want, but we're a body that works together to accomplish the Lord's mission in the church. And then we do all that, and now we're talking today about the third part, basically. We do all that to change the world. Basically, as a family, as a converted person, as a holy person, and becoming a family, we go out together to change the world. And that's what we're called to do. And we do that primarily, which we're going to talk about today, is through culture. And that's a word I think we hear a lot, but we don't often know, well, what is culture? That kind of, we know it, but we don't really know it. Like, what is culture? And basically, very simply, culture is the customs, the traditions, the mentalities, and the values of a people as a whole. And so it's this basically this huge influence on our lives. It's the way our culture thinks, our way our culture, what it says to us, what it speaks to us. And basically, very simply, we're children of our culture. We grew up, it's in a sense, it's kind of like our environment. It's all the things that are impacting us and influencing the way we think and the way we do things. We have a family culture. So you have your traditions in your family that you've grown up with over time. That's part of your family culture. And so culture and as a whole is beautiful. It's a beautiful, good thing. John Paul II loved culture. He loved the arts. He was an actor. And he loved his Polish culture in particular. And he strove very hard to preserve that, actually, when the Nazis and the communists were trying to snuff them out. And he was in underground theater because he believed so much in the beautiful, transforming power of culture. So it's not something minor. But... and its effect is very powerful. That's why he believed in it so much, because it has a powerful effect. It's not something insignificant in our lives. It shapes us. It forms us. And the problem is today, as we look around, our culture is not so good. It is. It does not shape us so well oftentimes. We get bombarded most of the time with very negative things and things that are not true and not good for ourselves. And so the call, basically, one is the first... thing we have to understand is we need culture. And one of the documents from the Second Vatican Council, which we've talked about a little bit, it says, is one of the properties of the human person that he can achieve true and full... He cannot achieve true and full human... Sorry. I'm going to start over. It is one of the properties of the human person that he can achieve true and full humanity only by means of culture. So that's a pretty strong statement in the sense that basically they're saying culture... is required for the fullness of our humanity. It's not something that we can just live without or cast aside. So it's necessary for us, for one. But then the second thing is we have to enter into it and we have to change it because it's not so good all the time. And so the church is saying that we have to enter into culture and we must evangelize it. We must speak to it and we must change it. And another document of the church talking about culture says, for the church, evangelizing means bringing the good news to all the strata of humanity and through its influence, transforming humanity from within and making it new. So that is the call of the evangelization, to transform humanity through entering into culture. And John Paul II tells us, the new evangelization requires a lucid, serious, and ordered effort for the evangelization of culture. So just that's setting the stage that it's necessary. We have to do it. This is part of our call as a Christian. And it is urgent. It's not something we have to put our whole effort into it. And because John Paul II says, the need for enculturization has marked the church's pilgrimage throughout her history, but today it is particularly urgent. So one, we need it. Two, we have to transform it. And in today's world, it's particularly urgent. So it's a greater call. It's always a call, but it's a greater call today. And so how do we do that? Basically, what's the format of doing that? And very simply, it's like yeast, that the Bible says we are like yeast that's supposed to enter into the bread and make it rise. And the key to that being yeast is that it's an entering into the culture and into the world. And there's two temptations, in a sense, or errors, you can say, that we can make about how we transform culture. And one is that we just submit to the culture and let it control us, which I think most of us, unfortunately, find even happening to us. Maybe we don't realize it's happening, but it's kind of what happens. We just let the culture feed us and tell us everything that we're supposed to believe and we're supposed to think. And that's basically what happens to most of us. We just submit to it and we let it impact us too much. And then the other temptation is that we create another culture separate from the world. In other words, we flee from the world. We say, okay, well, the culture of the world's not good, so I'm just going to make my own. But that's not true either. And that's not how Christ did it. The example of Jesus is that, one, he didn't stay in heaven. He could have stayed, but he didn't. And not only did he, so he left his home. He went out of himself, and he entered into the world in the fullness of it. He became a man. That's something we take for granted a lot, but he didn't have to do that. He's God. But he entered so fully into our culture, into our world, that he actually became a man, another human person. He didn't flee the world. He didn't flee heaven just for the sake of fleeing heaven. He didn't try to say, oh, the world's in bad shape, so he created another world outside of it. No, he went directly into the midst of it to redeem it. And so that is how we have to, that's our role, basically, as Christians. We're not fleeing the world, but we're also not letting the world control us and say, tell us what to think and how to believe and how to act. Does that make sense? There can be two problems, in a sense, when we try to evangelize culture. And so it says, this is a quote of JP2 again, and when he's talking about evangelization, he says, though independent of culture, the gospel and evangelization are not necessarily incompatible with them. So he basically is saying the gospel is bigger than culture, but it's not incompatible with it. He says, rather, they are capable, the gospel and evangelization are capable of permeating culture without becoming just subject to it. So we go into it, but we don't let it control us. And Christ basically did that, precisely that. He did not come into the world and allow the world to change him. No. He did not fall prey to any of its temptations. He did not sin as a result of the culture, but he did come into the world. And rather, he did the exact opposite. He changed the world. By entering into it, he transformed it. He redeemed it. He saved it. He elevated it. He uplifted. He brought it. He made it new again. And that's precisely our call again. We are not changed by culture in a negative sense, but we're called to go into culture with Christ, with the gospel, and to change it and to make it more beautiful. And so, but we often, I would say, allow the culture to affect us and we fall into its lies. Some of the current ones that we have to be very clear about that are lies, they're not true, is that we can't pray in schools, we can't keep a religious symbol at our desk, we can't wear a crucifix around our neck, we can't speak about the Bible in college. And the world basically is throwing God out. They say, we don't want you. But that's not correct, because Christ himself came into the world. And he didn't just stick in the religious circles. Understand that. Christ went everywhere. He talked to the prostitutes. He talked to the tax collectors. It didn't matter who it was or where he was. He was God, and he continued being God. He didn't change his ways based on who he was talking to or where he was. He remained himself always. So he always was God, and always was preaching the message, no matter who it was. It was the Samaritan woman that no one else wanted to talk to at the well, whether it was the adulterous woman that everyone wanted to stone. He entered into the lives of all. And so we're called to do that now. And many people say, they give us a lie. They say, oh, but you can't impose your faith on anyone. No, we're not imposing. But we can share it. We have to understand that that's a very, like a whip almost, that's thrown at a lot of Christians, if you can't impose your faith, well, you're right. We can't impose anything. No one forces it. That's actually inhumane to force anyone to do anything. But we are free to share what the Lord has given us. And everyone's free to reject that or accept that. That's our freedom. But does that make sense that we're called to share what we have? And that's okay. We share about everything else in our lives, but we refuse to share the greatest thing in about it. Oftentimes, we'll share what we ate for breakfast or what anything, but we won't share about the most important thing to us. And so it's not about imposition. It's not about forcing. It's simply about just sharing who we are and the gift we received. And that's just that simple. And John Paul II says, the church proposes, she imposes nothing. And so she proposes. She says, here, I have life for you. You can take it, or you can say no, but I have life, and I do want to give it to you, and I do want to share it to you. And so the next thing that we have to understand about culture and enculturating the gospel is that we have to make it accessible to people. The most concrete example of this is the scripture, the Bible. He doesn't speak English. In the sense, like, he's not in heaven talking to the people of the Trinity in English or in Spanish or even with words. He's a spirit. He doesn't have a mouth. Well, Christ does now. But basically, he took his word and he made them accessible to men in the Bible. That he made it something that we can understand. Does that make sense? So he kind of took what he had and he made it in a way that we could grasp it and understand it and hear it. And so we have to do that, and the same with too is Pentecost. What happened at Pentecost? The Holy Spirit came down, and everyone was able to understand in their own language. But what were they able to understand? And this is the important part. They all understood the one single gospel. And so there's another error sometimes when we want to make things accessible to people, that we downplay it, or we don't really speak the full truth because we're afraid of offending someone, or maybe we don't know how they're going to take it. We have to make things accessible, but we also can't make it something that it's not. So at Pentecost, it was heard in all languages so everyone could understand, but at the same time, it was the gospel, and it was the truth of Christ. And so, again, we have to make things accessible, but we can't alter the message of the gospel. And the third thing that we have to do with culture is we have to enter into it, and we have to purify and elevate it. And what does that mean, basically? It means that we have to take what is good. We take what is good in culture, and there's many good, beautiful things in culture. And so we take its goodness, and we elevate that, and we basically say, this is good, hold on to this. But if there's something bad in culture, then we have to say, you know what, that's not good for the human being. That's not proper to who we are. That's not our identity as a person, and we need to get rid of that part of our culture. Does that make sense? So some cultures have a very beautiful tradition of having great respect and honor for their elderly members, like grandparents. They have this high honor for the elderly. That's beautiful. That's an awesome thing because our elderly are wise and have much and great and beautiful wisdom. So that's a part of culture that we have, that we want to affirm. That's wonderful. And then, but if let's say we live in a culture, which I think we do a lot today, that we don't, we kind of do the opposite. We want to get rid of elderly. They're a burden. They don't know anything. We kind of want to stick them away so they don't really bother us so much anymore. That's not good. And so we have to speak forth to our culture and say, you know what, that's not true, good, and beautiful. That's not something okay. We need to change that. Does that make sense? So we take what's good and affirm it, but then we want to purify and get out of what is bad. And that's precisely, again, what Christ did. He became man, so he took on what is good. Man is good. We are good. We are beautiful. But at the same time, he became a man. He took on that humanity, that good humanity, but in order to get rid of the stuff that's not good in us. And there's stuff that's not good in us. But he's looking to purify us and take it out of us. And so the same thing means that we're supposed to do with culture. What does that mean practically? Very simply, it just means entering into every sector of human life and taking it and imbuing it with gospel values. So for example, if you're a filmmaker and you're an actor, make good movies that have good values, that are beautiful, and that give a good message. If you are a writer, write a beautiful book. Write good poetry that elevates the human spirit, that uplifts our minds and our hearts to the Lord. If you're an artist, make beautiful art that inspires people to God. If you're a politician, be a politician according to morality, to laws of the human, of the natural law, and to the good of the human person, instead of seeking your own gain or to harm the human person. If you are scientists, we need to work according to true philosophical, theological, human, and scientific truth. So I could go on and on and on, but the basic thing is, it's not, there's no special formula. It just means basically be what you are, but do it with the gospel in you and let it permeate everything you do. Whether you're a lawyer, a librarian, a mechanic, a chef, a jeweler, a teacher, a doctor, a nurse, or a secretary, it doesn't matter. Do that as a Christian. And so the key is that we don't annihilate culture. We don't say destroy it. We uplift it and we want to make it better. And so this is a very beautiful, it's a long quote of JP2, but I think it's very much worth reading because it says everything that I'm saying in a much better way. It says, the proclamation of the gospel in different cultures allows people to preserve their own cultural identity. So he said it doesn't destroy culture. The gospel is not opposed to any culture. It, on the contrary, the message which believers bring to the world and to cultures is a genuine liberation from all that disorders, from all the disorders caused by sin. Cultures are not only diminished by this encounter, rather they are prompted to open themselves up to the newness of the gospel's truth. And so I think you all have the point, but basically that the gospel helps culture, uplifts it, and it makes it more beautiful. So the last thing about culture is that we need to is that our faith has to become part of the culture, or else we're not living our faith. In other words, we cannot have this. Christianity is what we call an ethos. That means that it affects every part of our life, because if Christ is living in me, He's my center. Everything that permeates from me will be beautiful and good and true and holy and loving. And so if I'm an authentic Christian, everything I do is going to be permeated with the gospel. And so if our faith is not changing the culture around us, then it's not an authentic faith, basically. He has to mold our thoughts, our words, and our actions. And there can't be any split that we decide to be Christian one moment and then we decide not to be Christian another moment. So if I'm an actor in Hollywood and I say, oh, I'm a Christian, but then I go and I make a terrible movie that has a horrible message, that's a split in my faith. That's not, I allowed myself to be, I'm not whole, because I say I'm one thing, but I'm not acting upon it at all moments of my life. Now again, that's a process. We have to work at that. But at the same time, we can't allow ourselves to be satisfied with a split. And actually, that is precisely what Paul VI, when he wrote his whole encyclical about evangelization, he says that split, this is a quote from him, that split between the gospel and culture is without a doubt the drama of our time. That, precisely that split of the gospel and then the culture, which it doesn't touch, that's the drama of our time. It's actually the main problem. We call ourselves Christians, but we don't change the world. We don't imbue culture with anything that's authentic. We think that Christianity is just this private thing that I do. It's not. Because as I walk, as I move, as I talk, as I think, Christ should be like coming from me like a perfume to everything I touch. And so that is something we have to change about our understanding of what it means to be Christian and what understanding what it means to be united with Christ. And so Paul VI continues, therefore every effort must be made to ensure a full evangelization of culture. They have to be regenerated by an encounter with the gospel. But this encounter will not take place if the gospel is not proclaimed. And I think that very much summarizes it. They have to be transformed, but we have to proclaim. So one of the most beautiful ways of doing this, which we're going to talk about today, that kind of a big, like, okay, there's a lot of ways we can imbue culture, and I think one of the most beautiful ways is through beauty itself. Because God is love, God is truth, and God is beauty. He's not just beautiful, but he's actually beauty incarnate. So if we truly belong to Christ, we also should be beautiful, and the things we do should be beautiful. And so we have to bring beauty to what we do. But just like everything, that requires a formation. Because just like we don't know what authentic love is anymore, or authentic truth is anymore, we often actually don't know what authentic beauty is anymore. And so we have to, like, how many people, raise your hand if you've heard the saying, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Raise your hand if you think that's an accurate statement. Maybe? You guys are all nervous. You don't want to raise your hand. It's okay. You can be honest. Raise your hand if at one point you thought that was an accurate statement, at least. We're going to talk about it more, but it's actually not. Because that basically says beauty is whatever I want it to be. And that's not true. Because God is beauty. And so therefore, only things coming from God can be beautiful. So beauty is precisely actually not in the eye of the beholder. Beauty is something objective. It is something that, in a sense, we receive. And there are beautiful things, and then there are also things that are not beautiful. And they never will be if they are not from the Lord. And so, there's a beautiful quote of John Paul II he uses in his letter to artists, and it says, beauty will save the world. And this is kind of going to be the focus of everything we're going to talk about. Beauty will save the world. Pope Paul VI, and when he was speaking to artists, he said, the world in which we live needs beauty in order to not sink into despair. The world in which we live needs beauty in order to not sink into despair. So the world is desperate for beauty. Because beauty has the power to stir the heart and arouse us to wonder. It gives us an enthusiasm for life. It gives us a taste of goodness. And that's why John Paul II is able to write, beauty can save the world, because, well, very simply, God is beauty. So beauty did save the world in that sense. And so God is beauty. He does save the world. He is saving the world. But there's something more deep about that we're going to talk about. I would say, if you guys all agree with me, if you think about it, how many think we live in a world obsessed by beauty? I think we kind of do, right? Especially the feminine beauty in a very particular way. But we are often surrounded by ugliness, I think. We have this obsession with beauty, but we're often surrounded by ugliness. Why? Basically, beauty comes from God. And because we have started to reject God, our world has become less beautiful. It's just that simple. All beauty comes from the Lord. And as we throw him out of the world, beauty also leaves. But however, even though we were throwing the Lord out of the world, and we still yearn for beauty. We still are moved by it. We still desire it. We still want beauty. And so, basically, very beautifully, beauty becomes a meeting point or a bridge, in a sense, because we are desiring beauty. And very basically, we have thrown God out the front door and said, we don't want you. And when we hear the word God, a lot of people are like, nope, I don't want God. But beauty can kind of sneak in through the back door by another name, if that makes any sense. A lot of times, like, we don't want God, but we want things that are beautiful. And so, in a sense, beauty can be a bridge, and it can help people reach the Lord because our hearts yearn for it and we don't reject it so much. Does that make sense? So that we can, by simply being beautiful and doing things beautifully, it stirs people's heart to the Lord because it has the Lord in it. Anything that's beautiful has the Lord in it. So it can be a meeting point for people. It can help attract a heart that maybe is hardened to what they believe God is, or maybe doesn't understand him, but they're willing to open their hearts to something beautiful. And so it's a very wonderful tool, in a sense, of evangelization, because it can help us to reach people that necessarily maybe don't want to. They want God, but they don't think they do. Does that make sense? Our hearts all yearn for him, but a lot of times we don't understand who he is, so we reject him. And I won't go into that. There's a very beautiful quote about that, but basically it says that the true good and the beautiful are like three parts of trunks of a tree kind of coming out that all reach up to the Lord. And there's a Nobel Prize winner in literature. He said basically that even if you crush true and good, which we've kind of done, beauty will still manage to rise up and find the Lord. So it's kind of like beauty can become a way that we can reach people and help them to see and know God. It can lead them to God. This example, it was very much manifested in the example of St. Augustine. There's a very famous quote, and actually, how many people have heard the song Alive Again? Alive Again by Matt Maher. He uses, that's basically this, the quote I'm about to read is that the basis for that song. But that's what happened to St. Augustine. He was basically struck by the Lord's beauty, and it captured him. In that quote, it says, St. Augustine writes, "Late have I loved you, O beauty, so old and ever new. Too late have I loved you." And he says, "You were here and I sought elsewhere. I was deformed, drowning in those fair forms you made. But you called and you shouted and you battered my deafness. You shone and you glistened and you shattered my blindness. You radiated and I breathed in your spirit and I desired you. I tasted you and hungered, thirst after you. You touched me and I burned for your peace." So beautifully, St. Augustine encountered beauty. And it made his heart burn. And that helped him encounter the Lord. And so in what we call the way of beauty, is a privileged way to get in touch with many people who have difficulty receiving the church's teachings. Basically, it can open people's hearts to the search for God. It can dispose our hearts and our spirits to meet Christ, who is beauty. But the important thing, as we're talking about right now, is beauty, like I mentioned before, it's not subjective. It's not just what we think it is. It also requires formation, just like authentic love. A love is an emotion. It's not an emotion. We see the cross. That's not emotional. It's a choice and an act that we choose to make out of the good for the other. And so just like that, we have to form ourselves to what is authentically beautiful. Because beauty is also not exempt from error and distortion and disorder either. Okay, so that takes us to some of the principles of beauty. The first one,
I pull out my nice little thing. Take my cap off. I'm going to show you some pictures. I'm going to turn around and take a look. Oh, this is John Paul II, actually. This is him enculturating himself. I meant to show you that earlier. Sorry. So that is him, and that's a beautiful example of entering into a culture and allowing himself to be part of it, basically. Even though it's not his native culture, he was, like, you know, our universal Holy Father, and he entered into that. And here's another great example of that, playing soccer with the kids. Okay, so take a look at that. That's a pantry. All right, and now take a look at this one. Okay, now I'll show you one more example. Another pantry. And another pantry. Who can tell me the difference? Which one, actually, first of all, which one's more beautiful? This one or this one? Well, first or second? This one, one, this is number one, and this is number two. You can take your votes. Number two. So what do you think I'm going to tell you? That beauty is?
Order.
Orderly. Yes, beauty is orderly. It is not simply a mess of disorder. And I think there's another picture here. Here is your bedroom. No, I'm just kidding. Maybe. Here is another bedroom. Here is someone else's bedroom. Very clean. And here is another bedroom. And again, it's so obvious to our senses that which one is more beautiful? The one that is put in order. And is an order, basically, very simple. And you see that clearly. If I'm in a this is out of a picture, I'm sure, of like a magazine or some certain ad for this bedroom set. But the point is that why didn't they put this picture in their ad trying to sell their bed? Because we are not attracted by this picture, and they want to attract us precisely through beauty. And so, of course, they put this picture because this picture is beautiful. And beauty attracts us. It moves our hearts. It makes us want to have that. And so, very simply, I think you can clearly see that beauty is orderly.
And so does if you have a trash scattered throughout a city, does it make it more or less beautiful? And this is, maybe I'm the only one, and I did not feel this way, I remember, a long time ago. So this is a marvel in my own life. But how do you feel when you finish cleaning and organizing? Good, right? Like, there's a really good satisfaction when you just clean something and you organize and it looks all pretty, and then like 5 minutes later it's probably messy again. But for those 5 minutes, you feel really good. There's a peace, almost. There's an internal peace, actually, that comes from beauty and order. And so we see this not just in like bedrooms and kitchens and pantries, but in everywhere. Our bodies are ordered. Any one of you that have taken any kind of science class, there is a profound order to the human body. That's quite astounding, actually. Nature is ordered. There's an order to nature. Even there's an order in an intellectual level, and that's actually part of beauty. Imagine there's been moments in your life where, remember, where like when you learned something, you discovered something, and you were able to see its internal order and its harmony and how all these things came together and they connected, and then that light bulb goes off, and you're like, oh my gosh, that's so amazing. And you feel like you just discovered something. What are you amazed at? I would propose, in a sense, it's the beauty of that truth that you just saw, and how precise, but particularly its order, and how it all came together and just made sense, and all of a sudden you see it in a new light, in a more deep light. So even truth has an order to it. That's precisely what logic is. It's an order that says here, from here to here to here, and that's how we recognize something as truth, because it's ordered. It's not a chaos. And imagine the opposite. When you encounter an idea that doesn't make sense and it's disordered and incoherent and confusing, our minds don't like that. We don't like being confused and not understanding something. And so even that, there's order. Order brings peace, basically. And even art follows the Lord of what, if that would happen, how many people have heard Daniel play the piano? He's awesome at it. And what would happen if Daniel went over on the piano and started banging on the keys? We would all say, stop, please. Because even music has an order. Music isn't just pretty because I banged on the keys, but when I put those notes in a particular order, they become beautiful. And they become so beautiful that they can actually elevate our hearts and our mind to God, and actually they allow us to transcend. Like, music moves us in very deep ways, but not because it's just a note. No, when the notes are put in order, in a particular order, that's when they become beautiful. If I'm a painter, I don't throw paint at a canvas and say, oh, look at that, isn't that wonderful? No, when I put those colors in a particular order, in a particular way, it becomes beautiful. So I think you have my point that basically beauty is an order. And so we have to, what does that mean basically in our lives? Okay, what does that mean in my own life? If I'm going to be reflecting this presence, I have to have an orderly life. That's an authentic Christian witness. That includes keeping my room clean. That's a simple way. I know you're like, okay, what does that have to do with being a Christian? But it really does. Just having a clean house and a clean room, that's a display of your internal order manifested outwardly. It means picking up after ourselves all the time. If I'm at home, if I'm at someone else's place, it means doing my work in an orderly, timely way, basically, not in an organized way. Well, think about when you hand something in for school. Is it like a crumpled up piece of paper that your dog slobbered on? Or is it straight and crisp and typed and nice and neat? That, I know those sound like little minor things, but they're really not. That's a manifestation in a sense of beauty. Each one of those, you hand a paper into a professor and he gets it and it's all horrible and crumpled up and looking terrible, or versus it looks very nice and it's neat and it's ordered, that says something. Small, yes, but it's a manifestation of even our own order and beauty in our lives. Even how we dress and our appearance. Now, of course, we can be vain and over excessive, you know, emphasis on how we look, and we can spend 3 hours getting ready every morning. But we should... We are called to look nice every day, clean. We should smell good. We should have matching clothes. I mean, but the point is that even though we carry ourselves, even though we look each day, that says something about who we are. And as Mother Teresa, who lived in the heart of poverty, spoke very clearly of that. Actually, she said that all Christians should look nice. They should be presentable each day of their lives because we are beautiful and we want to show beauty all the time. Even living our lives according to correct and orderly priorities and responsibilities. So, for example, is it orderly that a father, a husband, a father of kids would spend half his day in bed and half his day in front of the TV. Is that orderly in terms of his priorities? No. So even that's a lack of order and a beauty in our lives. Even living our lives according to like our priorities, that's part of order. That's part of the way we order our lives. All right, the next principle of beauty is that all people, because we are all created for God, we are all created for beauty. So every single one of us has the possibility of recognizing and knowing beauty. First of all, if to be of God, to move the human heart, something actually really must be truly good and beautiful. But some things are simply not true, good, or beautiful. And if they're not, we can't use them to reach people because they can't transform the culture, because only what is of God can transform the culture. Does that make sense? That's first a foundation. So only things that are beautiful and good and true can we use to transform, because those are the things that come from God. But it shows us a mistake oftentimes that we want to make, to condescend to people in a sense, instead of really trying to raise them up to something more beautiful. It's like we want to go down their level and just let them stay there. Does that make sense? Because music, for example, so going on the same thing, music is able to speak to the soul and it's in a way that's really unique. It really does have a spiritual power that to do something to us that words can't do. Music speaks to us, it moves us, but it can also affect us in a bad way. And we do see that as well. So it can be used for both good or bad. And so, therefore, if we're called to use music to bring people to our God, we want to stir them to something that's really beautiful. But the point I'm trying to make with it is that the most beautiful way to reach people and to move their hearts, basically. Does that make, we all understand, I mean, I know, really, honestly evaluate what happens when you listen to certain types of music versus others. What happens to your heart? What does it do? What moves it? What is inspired by it? But the question is, a lot of times I think we want to lower down, and because we don't think people are capable of being risen up. That's my point that I'm trying to make. And so sometimes we have to realize that we're evangelizing culture. We want to be careful to say, I don't think you're capable of seeing something better and recognizing, no, but that's not true. And we do this in a lot of ways with truth, like with moral precepts. We say, well, I'm going to diminish the moral precept because I don't think you're capable of reaching the fullness of morality that the Lord has made you for and destined you for and gives you the grace to do, so that we can do the same with beauty. We want to give people truth and beauty. We cannot basically undermine their own dignity, but by not thinking that they're capable of recognizing true beauty. So the key, that's precisely the key, is that we do have to educate ourselves as to what authentic beauty is. That's the whole point, is that there is some things that are more beautiful, and we want to constantly try to bring forth that. Marissa?
I have a question.
Yeah.
You were saying that like there's like the different levels. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, what's like the highest? Like, can you like keep going up, or like is there like a...
In a sense, yeah, you can always, because God is infinite, and he's always infinite beauty. So in that sense, yes, there is no... beauty is never going to run out. We're never going to get to a peak of it. And so, you know, that's pretty awesome, actually, to think about that. In heaven, we're going to experience more and more beauty at every moment, in a sense, because he is infinite. And so, no, there isn't. There's no running out. So we can only get higher. But the key is that we want to continue to lift people higher. That's the whole point, is that don't allow ourselves to stay, but to lift always higher. I want to show you an example of this. Some of you, I think a few of you have seen this. How many people have heard or seen what I'm about to show you right now? A couple of people. It's really awesome. Basically, this is a great example of what I'm trying to say here, is that 650 people from Philadelphia in a choir went in this busy Macy's at Christmas time, and they sang the Alleluia chorus, what Handel's Messiah, in the middle of this four or five story Macy's, and it's amazing. They just walked right in, everyone's shopping around them, and this was an attempt to elevate culture, basically. And so I want to play, I'm going to kind of skip a little bit.
Imagine you going shopping.
There's people just normal. Yeah.
And all of a sudden.
I meant.
And not your shoppers that see this.
That right there, what I think is a great example of kind of what we're talking about. Basically, there's this organization that's called Random Act of Culture, and that's what they go around and do. They just basically try to infiltrate the culture with beauty, with a really, that's a classic, beautiful hymn, Handel's Messiah, I think it is. And they, 650 of them got together and did that. That was just 650 random people came together in Macy's, and that's beautiful because that's what they're trying to do, is they're trying to show, they're trying to basically educate the world again and what really something authentically beautiful can sound like. And so that's a great example of what we've been talking about. So, there, I want to talk about some of the ways of beauty. There are three main ways of beauty, and all kind of go in an ascent to the Lord. They help us rise, and the first one is nature. In a sense, way of beauty is nature. And this is a song basically showing us pictures of that, but also the words are proclaiming basically the Lord's beauty through nature. And so nature is a very powerful way to move our hearts. We've all, I think, been moved at one point in time by nature. And it, the reason why we're moved is because creation, in a sense, is a part of reflection of the Lord. It's His own beauty that He has made for us. And so it does in a very particular and beautiful way. It inspires us. It leads us to silence and prayer and praise and adoration and thanksgiving for all that He is. And it's it is an expression of God's own beauty. And that's why St. Francis is, who is our patron saint this semester, he, one of his most famous works is the Canticle of the Sun. And it is basically a praise of nature and how it reveals God's beauty to us. So in a very particular way, nature has an amazing power to reveal beauty to us and to speak to us of the Lord. And so that is the one of the first, if you so want to say, level of ascent of beauty is nature. It has a very revelatory power of the Lord's. But basically, the next level of ascent of nature is the beauty of art. And there's this is a clip from, there's a brand new school I'll give a little pitch for. It's called the John Paul II University. I think it's in San Diego, California. And basically the whole mission of the school is to, through art and particularly communications like filmmaking, acting and all of that, to elevate culture, basically, through having a correct understanding of what art is and what it can do. And so that's its whole purpose, is this, it's a new university in San Diego. And it's basically a clip of some of the students talking about their mission. That's what I was going to show you, and what they can do through the world of art. Like I said, particularly I think filmmaking they're going to talk about here. But basically a work of human art, whether it be a painting, a mosaic, a sculpture, architecture, poetry, music, literature, theatrical works, film, or dance, any of those, they all have the ability to stir our hearts and to provoke us to emotion and astonishment. And more than anything, and it can exit from self. They help us to move out of ourself and to they lead us to God. And in particular, they basically are pointers. They point us to God. They're not beauty itself, but they serve as a means of pointing, in a sense. Something that says, this is God. He's this way. And so the key with the art and Christian art and is that the where it takes its inspiration from is beauty incarnate, which is Jesus Christ. Jesus is literally beauty made flesh. And so the Christian artist should take his fundamental inspiration from Jesus, because he is beauty made into a person. And that's what gives the power of art its power, because it becomes a symbol of something that leads basically to Christ. If Christian art, if it's not pointing in a sense, somehow to Christ through its beauty and through its expression, it loses its purpose because it's meant to be an indicator to God. It's meant to be a highway, in a sense, to the Lord that helps us move to an elevator. And so a Christian artist can do that in an infinitely varied ways, but that's the fundamental way in which what they're meant to be doing, is they're meant to be a pointer to the Lord through their art and through what they're producing. I think it says, this is a quote from a document called The Way of Beauty of the Church, and it's beautiful. Listen to what it says about artists. It says, the artist extends revelation by providing it with form, image, color, and sound. That's powerful. The artist extends the revelation of Christ in the world by giving Christ color and form in an image. That's a powerful vocation, actually, of an artist, that they extend the revelation of God in the world. And so I think when an artist, like there's many artists in here, there's many kinds, we all are artists, in a sense, and I think that's, to see that's your vocation is something very moving, because we extend Christ's presence in the world. I think basically an artist is called to be a guardian of beauty. And that I think Paul VI said, is it not the task of saving beauty, that of saving man? And so the artist is called to be a guardian of beauty, and basically to save beauty, to uphold what it really is, so that, because when we save beauty, we help save man. And he can evangelize through that art. John Paul II, when he writes in his letter to artists, says, the image is also a gospel preaching. A holy image can express much more than words themselves, for its dynamism of communication and transmission of the gospel message is more efficacious. So the artist, whether it's something visible, whether it's music, whether it's poetry, has an ability to express the gospel more potently, more forcefully, in a way that words simply can't do. I'm going to summarize all that with the words of John Paul II, and again his letter to artists. He says, the artist has a special relationship to beauty. In a very true sense, it can be said that beauty is the vocation bestowed on him by the Creator in the gift of artistic talent. Look at that. Beauty is his vocation. And certainly this too is a talent which ought to be made to bear fruit in keeping with the sense of the gospel parable of the talent. So basically, John Paul II is saying that God has bestowed the vocation of beauty upon the artist, and that we are to render that service back to him to help him extend his beauty in the world. And the third, so that we have nature, we have art, and then the third and final beautiful way of beauty is the beauty of holiness. When the Holy Spirit shapes us into an image of Christ who is beauty, that is the most beautiful thing that can be in the world, is the beauty of holiness, of us being an image of Christ. And that's precisely why Mary is the most beautiful creature in all of creation, because she was an image of God without flaw or fault. She radiated Christ, who was beauty incarnate, from her. And that is why she is the most beautiful creature in all creation. Each very beautiful quote about the holiness, it says, each person, each saint, reflects according to their manner, as prisms of a crystal, faces of a diamond, contours of a rainbow, the light and original beauty of the God of love. Man's holiness is participation in the holiness of God, and by it his beauty. When this is fully welcomed into the heart and spirit, it illuminates and guides the lives of men and women in their daily actions. So when we become holy, we reflect God's beauty in a more preeminent way than nature, in a more preeminent way than art. This is the greatest reflection of God's beauty in the world. And very simple, how can we be credible in announcing the good news if our lives are unable to manifest the beauty of that life? And this beauty is not an exterior beauty, I don't mean physical, but an interior beauty that radiates from us. It shines before men. And this brings us really to the most deep understanding of the beauty that saves. Beauty will save the world precisely and most fully through our holiness. And we know that holiness saves the world. And so the beauty of a holy life is what saves the world. Because the face of Christ himself is manifested through his saints. It's given off through his saints. Pope Benedict, beautiful quote, when on his way to the First World Youth Day to speak to the youth, he spoke about this. He said he was, a lot of people think Christianity is all about a burden, I have to do this, and about all these laws that inhibit my freedom. And so the Holy Father spoke specifically about this. He said, he was speaking about himself, on the other hand, would rather help people understand that to be supported by a great love and by a revelation is not a burden. It gives wings, and it's beautiful to be Christian. The joy of being Christian is beauty, and it is right to believe it. That's a beautiful quote. It gives wings. It is beautiful to be Christian, the Holy Father said to us. So there is something that is beautiful about holiness. It's beautiful to be holy. Holy people are beautiful. So our lives are called, this is a wonderful quote, our lives are called to become an event, a susceptible beauty to arouse admiration and reflection and to incite conversion. So the beauty of our lives should arouse people's admiration and reflection and to actually bring about the conversion of their hearts because of the beauty and the joy in which we live our lives. When people encounter us, it should be an event of beauty for them, basically. Last and finally, I would like to get into this much more some other time, but part of that holiness is that the holiness of us, there's something more beautiful than that, and it's actually the liturgy. Because what happens in the liturgy is that beauty himself comes and he dwells among us. So that actually, that's the most beautiful act of the church. That, there's nothing more beautiful than the liturgy. There's no more act that is more beautiful than the liturgy when God, beauty himself, comes and he dwells among us. So that's the highest event of beauty, is actually the Mass. You know, we don't think that a lot of times and we don't realize that, but that's the highest act of beauty that happens on earth, even more than our own holiness. There's a legend that Cardinal Benedict said when he was talking about the Eucharist. Just to sum that up, there's a legend of the Prince Vladimir of Kiev. He sent some ambassadors to the Orthodox Church in Russia to check out what they did. He didn't have any idea of what Catholicism or Christianity was at all. So he sent these ambassadors to go and visit and see what all this was. And they came back to the prince. And they said to him, "We did not know whether we were in heaven or on earth. We are witnesses. God has made his dwelling place among men." Beautiful quote. And because of that, the witness of the liturgy and the beauty of the liturgy that they witnessed, the prince became Catholic. He converted. Not because of a logical argument, not because of someone speaking to him, but the beauty of the liturgy and understanding that God himself became present in the midst of that is actually what moved his heart and caused and incited him to become Christian. So that's, like, again, that's more, that I'm going to be honest, that's a whole other talk. I think we should spend a lot of time talking about the beauty of the liturgy. But just so you understand, that is the fourth and final and most sublime, beautiful event that can happen in the world. So very simply, in summary, beauty will save the world. And it will. And so the question is that it's like a perfume. I like to imagine it. Beautiful things are like a perfume. And so the question is whether are we going to emit that perfume in our own lives by making our lives beautiful, making the things we do beautiful. And that is the final question.